from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, earlier this week, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted that anyone who burned a U.S. flag should perhaps be stripped of citizenship or thrown in jail, both of which are unconstitutional. He has also tweeted that millions of people voted illegally in the recent election, which is not true. Both tweets received lots of news coverage, but raised the question, should news outlets cover everything the president-elect tweets, even if unconstitutional or untrue? And we'll discuss the multiple approaches news outlets are taking to cover the president-elect. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In this opening hour of Forum, we're going to talk about tweets, and we're also going to talk about the president-elect's messages to those who are on Twitter with him, and also talk about really the difficulty of establishing what the journalists ought to call, well, objective journalism, or at least accurate journalism, in the face of tweets that are sometimes inaccurate, sometimes, frankly, just deceptive and false. We have with us assembled a really fine panel. Let me introduce them to you. James Fallows is national correspondent with The Atlantic. He recently authored a piece called How to Deal with the Lies of Donald Trump, Guidelines for the Media. Jim Fallows, welcome back to the program.
Michael, nice to talk to you.
And James Fallows is with us from the nation's capital. Dahlia Lithwick is with us from New York. She's a reporter with Slate covering the courts and the law, and she also hosts the podcast Amicus. She recently authored a piece called We Can't Afford to Ignore Donald Trump's Tweets, and welcome, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Paul Wadman, who joins us from D.C. He's an opinion blogger with the Washington Post and a contributor to the Plumline blog at the Post and a senior writer at the American Prospect, and recently authored a piece called Trump Has Already Defeated the News Media and It's Unclear What We Can Do About It. Welcome, Paul Wadman.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. And Jim Fallows, I'm going to begin with you. And let's begin by actually talking about what you say in The Atlantic, which is the media is not built for someone like Donald Trump.
The premise I was trying to develop in that item is that there is an assumption built into most of our media practices for which you can see analogies in the world of sports or legal procedures or whatever. And the idea is that all sides to a political dispute and to journalistic discussion will be at least trying to tell the truth. There'll be some internal or external penalty for telling a lie or being caught in a lie so that most participants will do what they can to avoid saying, you know, outright truths. And I make the point that many of our politicians, for example, Bill Clinton, one of his most notorious moment of saying, well, it depends what the meaning of is, or did not have sexual relationships with that woman, he recognized that he was trying to avoid telling an outright lie. The difficulty with Donald Trump is, for whatever reason, he seems not to be fazed at all, either internally or among his supporters, saying things that are just immediately provably untrue. They range from the tiny to the massive. The massive illustration being this illegal voting claim, and so you can't play the game by the normal rules of simply saying the Republican Party says this, the Democratic Party says that. Take your choice, because from the Republican president-elect, there seems to be no internal constraint about saying things that just aren't true. And so I think the starting point for the media now has to be the unusual one, that whatever Donald Trump says is more likely to be false than true, and how we frame discussion from that starting point.
Well, in fact, you compare him to an alligator in terms of showing signs of remorse, which is an extraordinary metaphor. But you're also saying, in effect, you can't really determine whether what he's saying is likely true or false. So he's really manipulating the media at his will, isn't he?
He is, because I think you've seen over the past year and a half the difficulty the mainstream media have had in repositioning themselves to use words like lie. And what's strange is that it's often the least consequential things that are most dramatic here. For example, it's not really consequential that Hillary Clinton invented, we now know, a story about landing under sniper fire in the Balkans someplace, the famous corkscrew descent. But that stuck in people's mind because it was a specific thing she said wrong. And with Trump, there are things like that happen multiple times per day. He'll say that he was in an audience of 20,000 people in a hall that only held 3,000 people. He'll say the fire marshals did this and that when the fire marshals say, what are you talking about? He will say the Koch brothers begged him to take money. The Koch brothers immediately say, no, we did not. This is fantasized. And again, my point is that in the entire known previous universe of politicians, including Richard Nixon, there seemed to be some internal register when the politician was saying something that person knew was not true. Trump doesn't seem to have that register, and we need to keep up with that.
Well, this may open a new era for investigative journalism, but the real question is how can someone who plays with the truth the way he does or fantasizes, and also, by the way, is constantly saying hyperbolic things like nobody respects women more than I do and nobody's more presidential or more calm and so forth. I mean, how do you really challenge someone like that? How do you hold them accountable? Hold his feet to the fire.
This is a process that we in the media, we in civic society are in the middle of trying to cope with. And I'll say one other thing that I've gotten a ton of reader mail about, which is that over the last 6 or 7 months, I was doing The Atlantic something I called the Trump time capsule of recording day by day things he did, which were either provably untrue or outside the entire known universe of what previous nominees had done. For example, saying in one of the debates that Hillary Clinton would be in jail if he won, or attacking the Kahn family or whatever. I received hundreds of letters from people in the mental health field saying there's a certain kind of known pathology that matches what you're describing. And we at The Atlantic decided, I think properly, not to try to medicalize this discussion, that what we should talk about is observable things in Trump's own behavior rather than whatever diagnosis people might have. And I think it is proper to say, without getting into medicalizing, which we're not competent to do, that we're seeing things you can describe in generic terms as narcissistic. This is the way a narcissist would talk. And there is a—
But that's a behavioral disorder, isn't it?
Well, there is. But just as you can say somebody is cruel without saying he's a psychopath, or amoral without saying he's a sociopath, you can say that someone's behavior is narcissistic without implying a whole psychological diagnosis here. And I think that the evidence for his narcissistic behavior, whatever its origins, is just vast and basically undebatable. And so I think we need to reorient ourselves to saying someone like this, how do we deal with the fact that he or she has no filter on whether his comments have anything to do with reality?
And again, James Fellows with us from the nation's capital is national correspondent for The Atlantic and recently authored a piece called How to Deal with the Lies of Donald Trump, Guidelines for the Media. Dahlia Lithwick is also with us this morning. She's from in New York. She's a reporter with Slate and covers the courts and the law and hosts the podcast Amicus and recently authored a piece called We Can't Afford to Ignore Donald Trump's Tweets. Well, Dahlia Lithwick, you say in your piece, we shouldn't take our eyes off the real story as opposed to paying attention or undue attention to this twitchy Twitter finger, as you pointed, the 140-character spasms that he puts out. But after all, he's the president. We can't ignore what he's tweeting, can we?
We can't. And, you know, I was reacting to a number of pieces, including James Fallows, including Paul Waldman's, and they, I think, were sort of setting the table. And then there was a quick, I think, pivot from a bunch of journalists who said, we're getting jerked around, we're being led around by the nose, let's not all report on the flag-burning tweet, let's keep our eyes focused on cabinet positions and ethical lapses, let's not run as a pack and cover things that are not true. And so my posture going into that piece, and again, I'm not a journalism critic, I don't think about the journalistic side the way Jim does, but my posture was, we can't ignore any of it, you know, and I think that when journalists say, don't look at this, look at this, or this is the real Trump and that's the 4 a.m. Trump, we run the risk of exactly replicating what we did in the election, which is try to make this make sense for ourselves, to construct rules that say this is real journalism, this is not. And my feeling is that the tweets matter. They matter as much as the cabinet positions. They may not have the urgency that a cabinet position has, but they certainly, I think, are salient and important in understanding how Trump thinks about the world and what he plans to do. So I think the totality of my argument was simply, we as the media, and I don't even know what the mainstream media means anymore. I don't even know what we mean when we say how we're going to cover Trump, because there's so many of us doing different things. But I think the gist of what I was saying was, let's do both. Let's cover, you know, the important policy moment by moment, but we also have to say to ourselves, this other stuff, these 4 a.m. tweets, they matter too.
Well, also, you get into motivations here. I mean, there are those who say that they just write off Trump's tweets as, you know, impulsive derangement of some kind. And then there are others who say what's really going on are lying and deflections. And others who say this is all very strategic, very calculated. For example, when the New York Times went into this investigation of what he was doing financially overseas, suddenly, maybe even to deflect, he went off with his tweet about people who burn flags, you know, should be essentially put in jail, perhaps, or taken, have their citizenship taken away. In other words, motivation is kind of murky here, and really puts a lot of question marks in the minds of those who are trying to plumb the depths.
I totally agree, and I actually think that way madness lies. For us to try to determine if he is this, you know, evil chess master who is manipulating us all by sort of saying squirrel, and we all look to the flag-burning tweet and take our eye off the ethics issues, I think is not the purview of the press. It's not our responsibility to figure out if he's distracting us. It's our responsibility to cover both. It's our responsibility to absolutely drill down on the issues that we know about that are demonstrably true, as Jim says. You know, there are huge, huge questions every day that we have to be working on. But I also think to say, oh, you know, he's talking about jailing or stripping citizenship from flag burners, and that's just crazy, and why are all the news shows paying attention to that, is to, I think, undervalue how important it is when he tweets about fundamental rule of law issues, issues that really go to his worldview. I just don't think we are in a position, as Jim says, we're trying to figure this out as we go along. I don't think we're in a position yet to say there's a hierarchy of what is real news and what is a distraction. We have to cover all of it urgently and hope that some of it gets through.
So if Trump says, for example, President-elect Trump, there was election fraud and there's no evidence of election fraud, I mean, and suggests that there were immigrants voting illegally, say, in New Hampshire, where there's very few undocumented immigrants, does the press have to go after him, or should the press just present the facts and say this is what really is real?
I think the press absolutely has to go after him, and I think the press did a really creditable job of debunking that the same day and saying this is demonstrably false. It's not just about a lie. It's about a lie that has been used to perpetuate voter ID and vote suppression laws around the country for a long time. It's a law that, it's a lie that has real legs and it has real policy implications. And so I think when we're told, oh, that's just a distraction, you know, he's not really saying that millions of people vote falsely. Yeah, he is. And he's saying it to millions of people who believe that that is true. And so I think doing the work that we were slow to do before the election, which is saying, no, that's a lie. We're going to call it a lie. That's false. If this is your predicate for suppressing votes in the states, then that is a false predicate. I think we have to keep doing that work, because the alternative, ignoring it, is to allow something to continue to fester and to foster even more vote suppression in the future.
Again, Dahlia Lithwick, a reporter for Slate, is with us from New York, and Paul Waldman is with us from the nation's capital, Asian opinion blogger for The Washington Post. And, well, Paul Waldman, you say calling him out on his lies only reinforces his followers' views that this is a biased liberal press against him.
This is the catch-22 that I think that we in the media find ourselves in, because one of the things that he has done from the beginning is waged a kind of all-out assault on the very idea that there can be facts that, that you don't like. And simultaneously with that, he's assaulting all kinds of fundamental American institutions. So even something like, for instance, when he said that, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that the unemployment rate is actually 4.9%, but that's not true. It's actually 20, 30, maybe 40%. Well, you know, things like that, that Democrats and Republicans have always accepted, this is what the facts are. You can argue about what we should do with those facts, or what their implications are, whether they're meaningful or not, but we're at least going to accept that kind of basic starting point for our debate. When he casts doubt on even that, he's telling his supporters that you don't have to believe anything that anyone tells you. And this is kind of an extreme version of what Republicans, frankly, have been telling their supporters for a long time when it comes to the liberal media. The argument that, you know, for instance, led to the creation of Fox News is that you can't believe what you read in the New York Times or the Washington Post or that you see on ABC News, that because it's infected with liberal bias, it's all a lie. And if you tune into Fox and they tell you a different story, that makes you feel better, then that's the truth that you can believe. So Trump takes that, and like so many things, he just turns it up to 11. And that means that his supporters are in a position where they feel like they don't have to accept anything. And so when people in the media do this very sort of careful and fact-based and evidence-based debunking of claims like the idea that there were millions of people who voted illegally, they don't have to say, well, okay, he exaggerated that. They just dismiss it out of hand. And so it leaves us feeling like, well, what can we possibly do? What choice do you have when he says something that's false? And none of the options are good. You can ignore it completely. You can, you know, sort of bury it in the back of the paper and say, yes, Trump said something outrageous today, and here's what it was. Or you can do a comprehensive debunking of it. But none of those options really is completely satisfying because it doesn't solve the problem. And as Jim said before, you know, we used to have this common understanding that politicians, that whatever else you thought about them, none of them wanted to be seen as liars. And so they didn't want to tell too many lies. And if they get called out for a lie, they would stop saying it because even though some were more honest than others, none of them wanted to get this reputation. And Trump obviously just doesn't care. And so when he steps outside all of the norms that the system has operated under, it sort of makes the foundations of the system seem like they are starting to crumble.
I think it's Jim Fallows, in fact, who said neither truth nor shame seem to hold sway. But you raise the real provocative question here and the real conundrum of it. If you're essentially saying there's no truth in the media, if you're you even bring up somebody like Alex Jones, who's been completely repudiated on so many things, one of the most obvious being Sandy Hook was really a conspiracy to take guns away from people. If those are your sources and you're the president-elect and you have this following that believes what you put out there, whatever it may be, you maybe have defeated the media.
Yeah, I think in some ways he has. I mean, you can look at it and say, well, look, he got fewer votes than Hillary Clinton, and his approval ratings on taking office are probably going to be lower than any other president since we started polling. So maybe that's evidence that the criticism and the debunking is working. But at the same time, he is going to be president of the United States. And so, it raises the question. I know that I know a lot of people in the media who are now feeling like all the work that they've done is pointless. Obviously he's a situation that we just haven't confronted before. The idea that the president-elect of the United States is getting his information from, as you said, Alex Jones, someone who thinks that 9/11 was an inside job and that the children at Sandy Hook were actors, that that's where he's getting his information and then passing it on to tens of millions of people is just something that's so outside our experience that we can't really figure out how to deal with it. And I don't know anybody in the media who has figured it out yet.
Well, Jim Fallows, you have looked into this in great depth. It is a conundrum, as I said. Any suggestions about where the media can go or should go or ought to go?
I think the main issue is one that you're hearing from all of us and even implied too in your questions, which is that we're on new terrain. None of the principles that apply through any of our experience in journalism or public life are directly applicable to Trump. And so it's the beginning now, less than a month after the election, to try to figure out how American society can respond to this new phenomenon. I mean, let me suggest two lineages that lead to where there's a sort of political bias in the media lineage where over the decades, one newspaper or other or network has had identifiable biases. The Wall Street Journal's editorial pages has always been from a certain perspective, the New York Times from another. I think with the invention of Fox News, only 20 years ago or so, you had the beginning of sort of the siloedness of what presented themselves as mainstream media. But then with Trump, we have something entirely different where there is, as I think both Paul and Dahlia have written about, there's just this attack on the idea that anything is real. It's all subjective. The other lineage I think is very important here is that of pro wrestling. One of the most important videos during the campaign, I think, was one of Donald Trump a number of years ago shaving Vince McMahon's head in the ring. They had some bet about the outcome of pro wrestling, and it was all about dominance, all about performance. Nobody thinks anything in pro wrestling is really true, but it's all about sort of what they think. I think they call the kayfabe in pro wrestling, the kind of fake hostility. And we now have somebody who, through a million factors all going one way, is going to have the powers of the presidency. And I think I don't In the last couple of weeks since the election, I've tried not to dwell on the direness of the situation, but I really do think the realm of rationality, of self-government, of civic society, of ability to make democratic decisions is at stake in our finding some way to reestablish the concept of reality and of truth and of what is verifiable information we can make some decisions on the basis of, because without that, you simply can't have democratic self-government. And so it is an important solution we are trying to find our way toward, and nobody has the answer yet.
Well, let me go back to the tweets with you, Dahlia Lithwick, because somebody like Katrina Vandenhovel says media would be wise to stop hyper-coverage of his tweets. They distract, they distort, and they debase. And Chris Wallace of Fox News, and that's one of the sources that Donald Trump, the president-elect, goes to, you know, says even if it's libelous or scandalous, it's the president, so you have to report it. But again, the demand for proof for statements like where the president, that is President Obama, was born, or ISIS being somehow invented by Hillary Clinton. I mean, these are things that have to be held up to the light of truth. That's the job of a journalist. And how can this be done in the kind of different landscape, as Jim Fallows puts it, that we're living in now?
Well, I think I would just make two points. I think that the folks, and it's not just one or two. I mean, Jonathan Chait has written really brilliantly about this. Jack Schaefer has written brilliantly about this. So I think that very well-respected journalists are saying exactly what you're saying. Let's not all run to cover flag burning. Of course, it's unconstitutional. What he's saying makes no sense. We don't strip citizens of their citizenship for something like flag burning. So let's give it 5 minutes and move on. And I think there is one piece of truth there that's worth reckoning with, and that is when we act as a pack, when every single, you know, cable news show spends an hour debunking the flag burning, we miss things. But I don't believe that there's not enough journalism out there to do both. And so I think the very notion that some of this is false and some of it is worth covering and some of it is a distraction really makes a mistake about what we are capable of doing. We can drill down both on the, you know, demonstrably false tweets and on the ongoing, you know, policy problems. We can do both. So I think, again, you know, to try to create a hierarchy of this is what, quote, journalists and journalism should do is a way of mollifying ourselves. It's a way of saying we're not going to cover crazy stuff because that makes us crazy. And as both Jim and Paul are saying, we just have to cover the crazy stuff, even if it's just a lie. We have to stay on it. But I think one other thing, just to build on what Jim just said about the wrestling point, it's not just journalism, right? It's whole institutions. And I heard a surrogate for Donald Trump say yesterday, there's no such thing as fact. People believe that millions of voters voted illegally. It's true. And then citing one study. And I think it's beyond just journalism. It's whole institutions, think tanks.
Dahlia, I have to break in here because we're coming up on a break, but it does remind one of, I'm sorry to say, Joseph Goebbels and the way he operated with propaganda. Let me invite listeners to join us in the meantime, and you can do that at our toll-free number. It's available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Call us now if you have something to say about this or a question to raise. 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Many newsrooms around the country are debating what to do about the distractions, deceptions, and outright falsehoods associated with statements or tweets coming from the nation's president-elect, Donald Trump. And there appears to be a new and unprecedented challenge to the media on how its reporters, editors, and news analysts can best report about the president-elect, let alone how to hold his feet to the fire. And in this Forum Hour, we're looking at the challenges facing the news media in the Trump years. We have James Fallow with us of The Atlantic and Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Paul Waldman of The Washington Post. We're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith. I remind you, you can join us a number of ways. You can tweet us. There's been certainly a lot of talk about tweets here this morning. Forum at kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Actually, our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. And you can also call us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866. Well, it's not really available now because every line is full, but the number is 866-733-6786. And I want to bring Paul Waldman back into this, opinion blogger for The Washington Post, and just get your assessment overall, Paul. I mean, again, you kind of shrug your shoulders at the opinion piece that I've been alluding to that you did. But where to go and where to begin moving in a direction that can actually bring forth some sense of truth or reality here?
Well, I think one of the problems is that Trump offers so many different sorts of outrages and false things that he says and problems to investigate that it can be sort of overwhelming. And I think one of the things that happened in the campaign that you saw, for instance, when it came to things like conflict of interest, like the corruption of his foundation, or things like his bankruptcies in Atlantic City, what you would often find is that there were a couple of really good investigative articles about it somewhere in a newspaper, on TV, and then the subject would just kind of be dropped because there was so much else going on. And I think that if you look at that, obviously in contrast with the way that Clinton was covered, where it was emails, emails, emails on the front pages every single day for extended periods, you saw what kind of a relative effect that had on the two candidates. And so I think that in a lot of cases, if the media will focus in and not repeat itself, but investigate in depth some of the really serious issues, then I think that can have an impact. I mean, one of the sort of MVPs of news coverage of the 2016 campaign is David Fahrenthold from the Washington Post, who was for a while the only reporter who was really investigating the Trump Foundation. He uncovered a lot of new information, and his, you know, repeated stories, his lengthy investigation that took months, essentially revealed that the Trump Foundation is almost top to bottom a scam and has broken the law in some cases. And that may have actually had a real impact. And so I think that we have to duplicate that on a wider scale. Now, to a certain extent, it's easy for me to say because I'm an opinion writer and not an investigative reporter, and so I'm not the one who's going to have to be doing all that legwork, but it's absolutely vital that when we spot one of these important stories about things like his conflict of interest, that we don't just report on it for a day or two and then get taken in by the next outrageous tweet, the next, you know, thing that he says that's so inappropriate. Because one of the things that Trump knows is that the more outrageous he is, the more coverage he's likely to get. And that can enable him to just seize back the news agenda whenever he wants.
There is another element in this that I wanted to call attention to, and then I'm going to go to your phone calls. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times pointed out that during the 80s and 90s, when she was with the New York Post, she would get regular calls from President-elect Trump, and he would call in with items and so forth on a regular basis. But he would also put reporters and editors kind of against each other with different outlets fighting over his exclusives or his scoops or whatever you want to do. So, again, there's a real playing of the media here that has to be taken into account, something Jim Fallows has written a great deal about. I want to bring your calls in, though, and let me begin, David, with you. You're on the air.
Yeah, I want to thank you and your guests for the important work they're doing right now, and it's a critical juncture in our history. I would like to suggest that you think of a vocabulary to describe the actions that Donald takes. So, for example, one of the things he does is he takes a position, and then he takes the exact opposite position a few days later. And what this whipsawing does is it confuses everybody. So, you know, we've got to describe what he's doing to show how disingenuous it is, and not just follow it.
I'll let that stand as a comment, and I'll thank you for it. I want to get as many of you on here as we can. Lots of people want to weigh in. Let me go to Fred next. Fred, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a comment and a question. You know, it seems like everything that's wrong with Donald Trump is what's also right with him by the opinions of so many people. Like, for example, his lack of experience, it means to a lot of people, well, he's new and he's not corrupt and he's going to do a great job, or his abruptness and his argument, his style of argumentation means that he's just strong and he's a commanding leader. And this whole issue about him lying and speaking off of the cuff is also viewed as a positive by many people because it's his lack of, you know, sophistry, his lack of political correctness that, you know, all these other politicians are so well versed in, and they're going to lie to the American public in a very nice way, whereas Donald Trump is going to lie to the American public in a very abrupt way. And my question for, and I'll take it off of the air, my question for the guest is, you know, being a president-elect is very different from being the president. And when does impeachment proceedings become involved, and when does the line get crossed? And does anybody, you know, have a, you know, understanding or a comment or a question about that?
All right. Well, actually, there are two questions embedded in your comments, and I thank you for them, Fred. And let me go to James Fallows. First point he makes, I think, is one really to reckon with, Jim. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Those who support Trump and those who are strongly in his camp are saying, you know, he speaks what he feels and it's not politically correct. And we admire that. He's not a politician.
I think that's very much so. And the all the criticisms you could make of him relative to Hillary Clinton, that he wasn't experienced, that he was an outsider, he made into strengths very much as Fred, the caller, was saying. Let me, as opposed to address the second issue about impeachment, I'm not going to talk about impeachment itself, but I will say something about the actual job of being president that, for better or worse, Donald Trump now faces. I think that all these things which were politically appealing, his impulsiveness, his flamboyance, his willingness just to say things that came to the top of his head, it is almost impossible to overstate how dangerous these are for somebody who actually is going to be the president. Long, long ago, I worked for Jimmy Carter in the White House as a speechwriter. I've studied presidents since then. The two things that really stay with me about that job is, number one, how every day consists of a nonstop flow of impossible decisions, where any decision that's not impossible, somebody else will make. And so the president gets those that are like whether you do go into Syria, or how you deal with fracking or whatever, where it's a very close call, there's no good decision, and it requires an ability to judge a very large amount of information. That's one thing that really is required for presidential performance. The other is temperamental stability, that on a president's judgment, dozens of very important calls every single day must be made about military engagements and all the rest. And so if we think a sort of judicial temperament in the information sense and also in the stability sense, if those are two things that really matter for presidents regardless of party, I think these are grounds also to be concerned about the man who now is going to have this job.
Let me follow up with another concern. Listener Tom writes, and let me go to you on this, Paul Waldman. Tom says, WikiLeaks proved how the media is a wing of the Democratic Party. Trump has it right by talking directly to the people. 90% of the media are leftists, and middle America sees the extreme leftist bias.
Well, again, this is something that conservatives have been telling their constituents for a long time, that because people in the media are more likely to be liberals than conservatives, which is true, that therefore nothing that you read in the media do you have to trust. That if you know that, you know, if you took a survey of people who work at the New York Times, then more of them would be liberals and would be conservatives, then therefore everything that's in that newspaper is a lie, that nothing, that they have no professionalism, that they have no purpose to what they do other than advancing their own political partisan agenda. And that is really at the heart of what drives Fox News, what drives conservative talk radio, and what drives Donald Trump. And what enables him to create this kind of entire alternate universe. But as we said, what's different about him is even when confronted with the facts, many of his supporters don't care. And I think that, that the analogy that Jim brought up earlier of professional wrestling is a really revealing one, because if you ask a professional wrestling fan, don't you know it's fake? They'll say, of course we know it's fake. But you're just missing the point if you're caught up in whether or not it's fake. And we've seen this with Trump supporters. You know, when he spent months saying, you know, leading chants of lock her up, and then after he was after he won the election said, oh, you know, we're not going to go after her. Did his supporters mind? No, they didn't. Because
no, some of them did.
It was all a show.
Some of them did, though. I mean, there was some pushback from
A little bit here and there. But I've seen many, many times when they'll be confronted with some way that he's changing a position or some way that he's altering something that he promised. And to them, the promises are sort of just part of the show. They're the ornamentation. What mattered was the kind of emotional resonance of his whole candidacy. And the particulars are not that important. And if you say to them in 6 months or a year, you know, he broke that promise, I think from most of the promises that he made, his core of supporters, now that's not a majority of the public, but his core of supporters are not going to abandon him over one broken promise or another.
Let me go back, Dahlia Lithwick, to you and get a response from an email I've got here. Actually, it's a posting on our website from Gene, who says, please, newspapers have a president fact checker column front and center every day with the tweeter statement and then false or true and a footnote for fact checking. People have to understand that he is a liar, plus articles front and center on where the president has conflicts of interest that are ongoing, plus investigative journalists do a tweet in response.
I agree. I mean, I think this is happening. And I think the notion that, oh, everybody abandoned, you know, the substantive issues to follow the tweets is more of a reflection on who's listening to that and the news they're consuming than it is a, you know, reflection on the entire news media. I think the entire news media did a pretty good job of covering, and I agree with both of the panelists. It took too long for the real deep dive investigations to happen, but we did it, and we're doing it. And so the idea that we can't hold both ideas in our minds, that, you know, one kind of journalism and another kind of journalism can coexist, I just think is wrong. I think if you're consuming a news outlet that is focused only on the flag-burning tweet for 24 hours, then you need to turn the channel and watch something else. But it's out there.
We're talking about the president-elect of the United States, but Dahlia, some have suggested that trolls ought to be ignored and that sometimes this president-elect behaves like a troll?
Well, I think I wrote that article a year ago, you know, that we should just ignore Trump because all this coverage is only helping him, and I am wrong. Clearly, we are going to have to deal with it, and I think that we have to unbraid. I think two of the things that Paul just said are really important. There's a difference between a country in which we don't agree on facts, and that's a problem, but now I think we're at a much more pernicious moment. I think we're at a moment where we think facts don't matter at all. It's not that we are disagreeing about facts. It's that there are no facts. Everything is up for grabs. And I think if we don't in the media, and it is a problem, I think that the left tries to say on the one hand and on the other hand, and that, you know, maybe we've tried too hard to say, you know, there are two plausible positions here, and I don't know what the alternative is. But I think it's really important to stay on this job of saying, I don't care what your study says. The Pew study matters. I don't care what your opinion poll says. You know, these polls matter. And to keep hammering on the fact that there are facts and they exist, and the fact that you don't like them doesn't make them go away.
We're going to go to more of your calls, and let me bring in Jonathan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, my question is, I haven't heard anybody ask to see Donald Trump's birth certificate. Now, I don't know if it's beneath the mainstream media, serious journalists, and I'm not really talking about whether he's a U.S. citizen. I'm really talking about the fundamental humiliation that he subjected the previous president to. And I just don't know that sitting back and taking the higher road is really going to help. And by the way, maybe we should ask for tax returns again.
Well, there's a lot of asking for tax returns, James Fallows, but they don't seem to be appearing. They didn't appear, in fact, until right up to the point where Trump was elected, and I doubt that they're going to appear now.
Right. And this is one of many just basic norms of how the system operates that Donald Trump has just blithely barreled his way through. And I think that is one more point about the Trump era that we talked earlier about how this is different terrain. There were things you expected participants in the system would do, and that they're the rules of constitutional government spell out so much, but norms, expectations of principled behavior are the rest of it. And so we'd had this norm since the Nixon era of turning over the tax returns. I think there's an important physics force vector point here, that until somebody in the quote-unquote responsible Republican Party finds it in his or her interest to start standing up against Trump and say, look, we're not going to consider any of your nominees until you show your tax returns. We require your cabinet nominees to show their tax returns. Why not you? We're not going to pass your budget until you comply with these parts of the conflict of interest laws, this so-called emoluments provision and divesting yourself of the business empire, et cetera, until somebody in the Republican Party, which now controls both houses of Congress, decides that it's time to take a stand against Trump, this is going to be difficult. I think sooner or later someone will peel off in the Republican Party, but that is a very important part. And I'm not aware of any responsible Republican in the 3 weeks since the election standing up to say, 3+ weeks, say, look, we need to have this is something we've expected from presidents-elect. We'd like to see it from this president-elect.
Jim, you've addressed both in your writing and here on the air the whole problem of using the word lie. And I've got an email here from Mike who says a big problem for him is that most journalists do not use the word lie when describing Trump's statements. And there's a difference between lying and saying something false. And Trump clearly crossed the line into lying. Why not call it what it is? New York Times certainly grappled with that, didn't they?
I agree. And I think that this is one more case where the there's been a real hesitance in the news system. I think a proper hesitance to call things call people liars or call things lies just because you wanted to lay things out for the public. Say, here's the evidence. The politician said X. Our evidence shows Y. You judge for yourself what the politician is doing. But again, we are in different terrain now, where on things that are immediately disprovable, where, you know, the size of an auditorium, Trump will say there are five times as many people who were there than actually were, things where it's not a judgment call about whether there was, you know, for example, many people who are critics of President Obama say that his claim, if you like your health plan, you can keep it, that that was a lie about Obamacare because the provisions of the law, as eventually unfolded, didn't allow for that. That was clearly a political misjudgment as opposed to a lie as we normally think of it, where it's a sort of a very black or white thing that you knowingly are misstating. In Trump's case, there's lots of things that there's no doubt whatsoever he's making things up, and he still says them. I think there we are, that the media are too slowly but properly coming to calling these lies and recognizing he has a pattern of being a liar. We're properly slow to say that, but I think it's the time to say it.
We did ask listeners on social media how they would like the media to cover a Trump administration. Let me just give you some of the responses. Sherry says, skeptically. Gene says, ask follow-up questions. Don't just accept his platitudes. Call him out on his lies. Demand real answers and not vague promises. And Chris says, treat him with same reverence afforded Obama. And let me bring more callers on. And we go to you, Roxanne. You're on.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for taking my call. And I really appreciate the fact you're having this program. I wanted to speak to the gentleman that talked about the psychoanalyzation of Donald Trump and how it's not really the media's role to psychoanalyze him. And I'm in agreement about that. But one of the things that I've often thought about is, are the news agencies and the media people that are more adept at discerning things, are they given any training by somebody who could come into their organization who works specifically with the narcissistic, passive-aggressive personality? Because there are coping mechanisms that can be put in place in order to deal with somebody like this. I think it would be very helpful for them to have, like in their toolkit, something that they could use that could help get the news out there in an effective way and not have the media be so hamstringed and utterly frustrated, because I know the public, or a lot of the public, is frustrated with the level of news media that we're seeing and the types of coverage that we're seeing.
Yeah, thank you for that call, Roxanne. And Paul Waldman, I think it was Trevor Noah, who said the media should treat Trump like a child, basically.
Yeah, and it poses all kinds of questions and problems because he is so different than other people, especially with that kind of impulsiveness, the lack of concern for whether or not he's being seen as a liar. And some of it is just sort of instinctive, I think, on him, and some of it is very calculated. You know, Carl brought up the issue of his tax returns. That's another example of a norm that we've had for decades that he just decided he wasn't going to abide by, but it was a very calculated move. He thought to himself, I am sure, I'm going to get some criticism for not releasing them, but I don't want to release them for whatever combination of reasons, and I can withstand that criticism because it's more important for me not to. And so, in the end, he was right. He could withstand it. He was able to endure whatever criticism he got, and he didn't have to release them, and he's never going to release them because he made a calculation. Now, we in the media could have increased the cost if we'd wanted to. It could be that if we'd wanted to, every single time he got interviewed, the first question would be, when are you going to give us your tax returns? Why haven't you released your tax returns? It could be on the front pages every day. That would amp up the pressure and change the calculation for him. But, you know, that's something that is probably not going to happen. It's going to come up every now and again, but is not going to, you know, the pressure isn't going to increase to the point where his calculation changes.
What you describe is revelatory of a kind of weakness on the media, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it's often hard for us to sort of act collectively in that way or take a long view or make what in retrospect looks like the right decision. But you know, those are the kinds of challenges that he presents us with.
Yeah, I know Dahlia Lithwick wants in here. Go ahead, Dahlia.
Yes. No, I was just going to say, you know, I spent the entire summer trying to write about, you know, 9 months of an unprecedented blockade of Merrick Garland. Nothing of the like has ever happened. It's not even close to what was done to Robert Bork. And the feeling that, you know, the media was just I think, following around, like whatever the craziness was that, you know, was the story of the day, I think did depress coverage of things that really do seem important, like the tax returns, like, you know, in my view, this unprecedented blockade at the Supreme Court. So there are clearly problems systemically with journalism and how we responded. We were so
Excuse me, Daya, it's been said many times on this program, why didn't the media go after Trump on climate change? He said he was going to rip up the Paris Agreement, for example. It never seemed to come into the discourse. And there was no aggression on the part of media on that. In fact, it didn't even come up during the debates.
It didn't. So many things didn't come up. We didn't talk about the fact that he was going to torture people very much. I mean, there was, I think Paul made the point, there was such a flurry of it. There was so much that it was like a fire hose, and all you could do was sort of contend with one thing at a time. But you're right. I think the absence of coverage of some really important salient issues is on us.
And I want to go to more callers here. Jim Fellows, you wanted in here, though?
Yes, two quick points. One is on the direct question that the caller asked about whether people in the news media are getting instruction on these issues. I can say at The Atlantic, yes, we've received a flood of mail on this exact point. And the other point, again, is I think the media have fallen down on coverage of various of these issues. But until the Republican Party is willing to say, OK, this far and no more with Trump's unprecedented moves, it's going to be hard.
I'm also looking at some tweets here. I want to bring them in. And one listener, Jed, tweets, all your guests are discussing ways to get Trump. This is why they lost credibility in much of America in the first place. And another tweet from a listener says, please talk to the idea that Trump's tweets talk past traditional media to his base and it's not meant for traditional media. I think that's what you've been saying all along here, Jim Fellows.
Sure. And this is the latest incarnation of something that innovative politicians have done for a very long time, that Ronald Reagan was going around traditional media with his roles as an actor and a radio broadcaster, and Jimmy Carter, whom I worked for, was going around the establishment with his town hall meetings. So this is not something that, you know, successful politicians have done this for a long time. This is the latest version of it.
I want to read a couple more emails. Jim writes, maybe it's best to report what he does, not what he says. In speech, there is no difference between fact and opinion in our new age of unedited, raw publications. And Joseph writes, the media not only gave Trump a pass on truthfulness during the campaign, they used Trump's outrageous lies for hours and hours of airtime. Why should I take the media's rage now over Trump's lies as anything other than creating another big hullabaloo to get greater audience? Except for democracy, now the media has lost their validity. And Helen says the best way to deal with someone who craves attention so much is to ignore him. The media, the followers, the trolls, they all just egg him on. This daily reporting of Trump's tweets is creating a lot of noise that distracts from the issues we all need to focus on. I did monitor Trump's tweets for a while and have unfollowed him. It feels good. Let me bring another caller on here, and we'll go to you, Dean. You're on. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I remember you mentioned Goebbels a little while back, and the first thing that popped in my mind was how the mainstream media was essentially the propaganda arm of the Bush White House when we invaded Iraq. I was wondering if we learned any lessons from that period.
Good question, and thank you for it. Paul Waldman.
You know, there are ways you can argue that we didn't, but I also think that that this whole experience that we've gotten to now is going to make reporters much more skeptical about what comes out of the Trump White House, not just what comes out of his Twitter account, but what they tell us in general. You know, when we got to 2003, there was a presumption, even despite the Nixon years and Vietnam and everything that had happened up until then, that when a government official says we have intelligence that tells us X, that they're probably telling the truth. And yes, it would be great if it's possible to verify it, but the idea that they would just be making something up out of whole cloth seemed fantastical to a lot of supporters. And so that's what helped the Bush administration weave a kind of this story about how if we didn't invade Iraq, they were going to destroy us with their huge arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. I think that this campaign is going to make the people who cover the administration much more skeptical of what comes out of there. I'm not sure what the consequences of that are going to be, but as the person writing in said, now we're going to be able to focus on what he actually does. Remember, the campaign is just about talking. That's all the candidates do is they talk. And so we have to cover the things that they say. But now that he's going to have actual power and going to be appointing 4,000 people who are going to be doing things every day, we're going to be able to report on the consequences of his decisions and the things that the administration does that affects people's lives. And so hopefully that will get the kind of attention it deserves.
Again, Paul Waldman is opinion blogger for The Washington Post and contributor to the Plunline blog at The Post. And here's another caller, and that's you, Matthew. Thanks for waiting. Join us.
Yes, thank you for having this program. I just had two points I want to bring up. First off, what are we supposed to do as Americans and the media as a whole about the percentage of Trump supporters that are essentially willfully ignorant, if not stupid, in the sense of not wanting to hear the facts and the truth about Trump's lies, you know, as you pointed out throughout the show. Number two, I just wanted to ask, what does the panel think about kind of the misogynistic coverage of Hillary and that everything she did had to be inherently untruthful because she's a woman, and how that might have affected the general appreciation of issues about Trump.
Okay.
And
thank you for those questions. And Daya, let me go to you.
I think I just want to reinforce the very premise of Paul's piece, which is if there's no doubt in my mind that there is an Alex Jones panel right now where they're saying, you know, liberal journalists lie and they're trying to get Trump and, you know, the exact inverse of the conversation we're having here. And so I think the caller gets to me what is the most essential problem, which is that this is a conversation among people who agree that what Donald Trump says matters and that lies matter. But I think there is a world of people out there who don't agree with that, and there's a media machine that is fueling that world, and that to me is the real challenge going forward. I think it's the thing we have to figure out is how do we get back to a place where we're not in two bubbles, one bubble saying Trump lies and it matters, and one bubble it says liberal journalists say Trump lies and they're wrong.
Excellent point to end on, and thank you, Daya Lithwick. Daya Lithwick, again, reporter for Slate, covers the courts and the law, and also hosts the podcast Amicus, and recently authored a piece called We Can't Afford to Ignore Donald Trump's Tweets. Thank you, Daya, for being with us this hour on Forum.
Thanks
to you, Paul Waldman, opinion blogger for The Washington Post, contributor to the Plumline blog at The Post, and senior writer, American Prospect. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, James Fellows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, recently authored a piece, How to Deal with the Lies of Donald Trump Guidelines for the Media.
Thanks, Michael.
All the links are on our website. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.